Hi, my name is Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober to the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. Although Alcoholics Anonymous is a democracy, I noticed they made an exception for Big Jim, you know, that he could get his pin any time he comes in, he can get his pin. I like that. I think that's good judgment. I don't like raffles, but once I found out that Marty had made an anatomically correct teddy bear and was giving it tonight, I bought a number of dollars worth of prizes, and I'm sorry that I once more am deeply disappointed. It's really nice to be here. It's a privilege, you know, to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been nice for me to come out here and spend some time with my friend Len, and we went out and you drove me out to the coast today, and we got to see your lovely coast, and that was new for me, and your forests, and I am just so impressed with this Northwest area, you know, with the beauty of it. You live in God's country. This is very special. And I listen to your enthusiasm as I look around the room. You have a great brand of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can get to CAA in a lot of different places, and you obviously have something very nice here. Congratulations. Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like for me and what happened and what it's like today. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 14 years old. That was a big deal for me. I was 4'11", I weighed 95 pounds, I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. And as far back as I can remember, I never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different. Wanted to be bigger, better looking, wanted to be an athlete. Kept trying out for football, but I had a back problem. I had a yellow streak down the back of it. I think, you know, if you would have asked me what the most important thing in the world was for me, it was belonging. And there always seemed, no matter where you are, there's a group of people who are kind of the in-group. They seem to know more about the business of living than the others. It's like they knew some secrets. You know, I heard you hear that described in lots of different ways in AA talks. The one I liked the best is someone said it was as if everybody else got to school a half hour before you and had a meeting and decided what they were going to do for the day and you missed the meeting. That's how I've always kind of felt about life, you know, like there was a meeting. I missed the meeting where they gave the instructions, you know, and so I kind of faked it, kind of pretended like I knew what the instructions were and I was going to kind of act like that, and then I'd hang around with the people who really knew what it was, and then I'd overhear some of the conversations and find out what I was supposed to do. And so I acted like I thought I had to act to get to be part of the in-group, and I got to be a marginal member of the in-group. But even after I got there, I didn't feel like I was, you know, belonged there. I felt like I was there because I was acting the way they wanted me to act, and if I stopped that, they'd ask me to leave. One night we were at a party, and a friend of mine had a fifth, and we went out, and we split that fifth, and I made a discovery. The discovery was when I put alcohol inside of Bob Bazans, I got a feeling of comfort and well-being, the likes of which I'd never experienced up until the time I took that drink. I mean, it was just marvelous. It was magic time. From that moment on, I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. I mean, it literally, you know, kind of changed things. It really does change things. I mean, you're, you know, able to, lots of us, you know, dance, talk to girls, move around. I was in a military school. It was really kind of a strict school. My first drinking experience was at an upper-class party that my sister was at, and you didn't hang around with upperclassmen. I mean, you were in trouble. You showed up at the wrong party, and you'd have shoes to shine for about 3 weeks, you know. But there I was, and I was, you know, it just was magic time. All of a sudden, I was part of and belonging, and from that moment on, I became a social drinker. Anytime anybody else said, I'll have a drink, I said, so shall I. I just never, ever, ever passed up an opportunity to drink. We did a lot of drinking in my high school. My high school was on a college campus, and I think we were kind of acting like we were in college. And we did, you know, by the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was a serious subject of negative conversation in my home. Come from a great home. And I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought my drinking problem was my strict father's attitude about it and the fact that you were underage. If you're underage, there's no okay use of alcohol. I mean, the issue always was, were you drinking, period. Didn't matter if you had one drink, didn't matter if you had 10. Were you drinking, period? I never wanted to get caught with one drink. I mean, getting in trouble for having one drink never made any sense to me. So at least if I was gonna get into trouble, I was gonna have a good time. And I figured that if that's the setup, you know, that's not working very good. If I could get someplace where I was allowed to drink like an adult, you know, where I could sit around and have a beer or have a drink, no one make a big deal out of it, my drinking had become normal. So I had a chance to go away to school, and a large part of how I made that decision was based on getting away from that authority, and I thought my drinking had become normal. It didn't become. You would have had a different talker here this evening if, you know, had my drinking straightened out. Make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. One day I just walked out. You know, I had my picture in the yearbook, I had my class ring, I just forgot to finish the year, you know. One of those things. It's kind of funny how things go. I had a son who thought he wanted to go to school down there, and we went down and went back to campus, and I took him down there, and I was walking around that campus. And I've always had a, you know, kind of a deep sense of failure about that. You know how people are always asking alcoholics normal questions, and they're not normal questions for an alcoholic. They always ask you, where'd you go to school? And there's this pause, you know. You kind of wonder, kind of going through the Rolodex, you wonder how much they really want to know, how much time they have. Are you married? And there's this pause. Kind of go through the thing. Do you work? You know. I mean, there's, you know, these are average questions. I understand that people in the world ask each other these questions all the time, but they cause great distress to people who have from our background. So I used to get asked this question like people cared, you know, I mean, it was just a social question, and I'd, you know, have this upset about it. And as sometimes God would have it, I was asked to give an AA talk down at Notre Dame, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, or maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And I went down there, and it was really kind of a fulfilling experience for me. I got to go back and relive some memories and make a couple of amends and kind of sort that out. And I'm in the middle of my talk, and I said, you know, I've always had a deep sense of failure about this place. And I said, I think I finally figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. It was a moment of clarity. It was, up until that time, it was much more complex than that. I was due to be commissioned as an officer in the Army. I was in ROTC, and I had to get a medical release or I would have been drafted. And the medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic at age 19. I thought that was a screwy diagnosis, but at least the good part of it is it got me out of the service. And I left school, came home, showed up to a set of very disappointed parents, went to a local school. And when I finished school, the family asked me to leave the house. You know, I'm one of seven kids, great mom and dad. No particular reason why I should have been a drunk other than genetics. We have wonderful genetics in my family for alcoholism. But they said, we love you and we care about you, but you're a mess. You're a bad example or a problem. We can't, you know, you can't follow the rules in the house, and good luck. And armed with my college degree and my newfound freedom, I struck out to make my mark in the world, and I took a position as a carryout boy in a liquor store. I almost killed a little girl one morning backing out of a driveway drunk, knocked her off her bicycle. I lost that job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. I ended up taking a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis. I'm living on, well, for about 6 months, I lived on close to Skid Row or Skid Row. I'm living in, you know, day apartments. I'm sleeping around. I'm working as a waiter. Get up at, you know, this is kind of the tackiest part of my alcoholism. I get up at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, drink a six-pack of beer, take a couple of Dexedrine, I go to work as a waiter, and I work from 11 to 2. 2, I'm off. I go drink beer in a bar. From 2 to 5, I go buy a fifth. Put the fifth in my locker, pour it into a half-pint bottle, and wait tables for the rest of the night. And then I find out, now this is downtown Minneapolis. Minneapolis and St. Paul are about, you know, 7 miles apart. I had an apartment in St. Paul, and 6 months I made it home about 15 days. You know, I kept meaning to, but I just... So I'd find a place. At the end of that period, I had a waitress and a waiter I worked with who was a heroin addict. His wife was a prostitute, and she and I shared a room for about 2 weeks. And when she had a customer, I used to have to go walk around the block, and when she was done with the customer, I got the room. And things weren't going well. You know how you got a game plan? You kind of know how it's going to be. You got it all written out, you know? And those Dr. Seuss books, you know, those are actual photographs of people I worked with in those days. Those are, it's my memory. It's just the way it was. And I went to a party one night, and I got into a fight, and I got my face kicked in, and they fired me. Didn't want me waiting tables looking the way I looked. And I had no place to go. God, I was broke, and I had no job. And I thought, God, the family must miss me. You know, Mom hasn't seen me for a while. And you know how it is. All of a sudden, it shows up as a pretty good idea that maybe you should go home. And I went home, and I said, hey, can I come back? And they said, yeah, under certain conditions, you can come back. You know, and they laid out the conditions. And like a good little drunk, I promised to follow the rules. They let me back in the house. Alcoholism meant a lot of different things to me. Maybe what it meant more than anything else is I had to start my life over about every 6 months. People who are in this room who have the disease of alcoholism, who have been married to someone or strongly related to someone who had the disease of alcoholism or drug dependency, knows about starting over. We don't know a hell of a lot about finishing, but we know an awful lot about starting over. I thought that if I could put certain things into my life, I could order my life. If I could find a woman that I loved and she loved me and we got married and got some structure, because I just need a little structure. I'm not a self-starter, and I think, you know, maybe a little order would help. If I could get a job that was really a career sort of thing rather than just screwing around waiting to see what the service is going to do with me, and if I could get out of the house, which was interesting because I was just moving back in the house, I was the family problem. You know, I can't tell you how many nights I cried myself to sleep listening to my parents fight about what to do about me. You know, I mean, I was it. You know, the family, I didn't like that. I loved my family, and I was, you know, just constantly at odds. You know, when you're in a large family and you have about five people to give you the look, you know, I mean, it's bad enough if just your wife gives you the look, but when you have your brothers and sisters start giving you the look and your mom and dad give you the look, it's really kind of, you know, kind of tough. So I started to put the things into my life that I thought would order my life. I got back together with a woman that I had gone with for some time. We broke up for almost a year, and we became engaged. We married, and today she's my lovely wife, Linda. And Linda's a real active member of Al-Anon, and I know that most of you, when you came in AA, you know, and you got sober, your problems stopped. Mine, I even had problems in sobriety. It's, I know that's disgusting, And I think if we both didn't have a program, I don't think we would have made it. I think we would have turned our lasers on each other and melted each other. And I think, you know, it's kind of the fact that we were able to, you know, keep our focus on ourselves and, you know, gave us just enough of recovery in our house that we've been able to hold that together pretty good. Got back together with Linda, became engaged, married, got a job as an executive trainee with a manufacturing concern, bought my first car. And I thought, hey, it's finally going to happen. You're finally going to become what you always wanted to be when you grew up, only it didn't happen that way because I continued to drink and have problems. Big corporations are tough places for young alcoholics. They're rigid. They got a lot of rules. They like to have you come in on Mondays. Like to have you... Well, at least they do in Minnesota. I don't know how it is out here, you know. Like to have you stay on Fridays, and they got lunch hours, and, you know, you wouldn't believe all the things there. And I was, and I did not fit in. It was an engineering concern, and I was in civil engineering when I was there, and I just couldn't hack it. And after about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I knew that I needed to get the hell out of there before I got fired. I took a job selling business equipment, and I had that job about 6 weeks. And I went out on a 4-day drunk. And the first couple of days I called in, the next two I didn't. And I woke up in a friend's apartment after a 10-hour blackout, and I woke up, I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live. And I was kind of panicked. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my psychiatrist and the recommendation of my father that I look into Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so impossible. And I picked up the telephone and I called AA, and I got Stu'd on a central office. And I said, my name's Bob. I think I may have a drinking problem. Could I talk to someone? And Stu talked to me for about a half hour on the phone. Then he got on a different line and called a couple of guys, and he came back on. He said, could you meet two guys in an hour at a cafe? And I said, yeah, I can meet two guys. He described the two fellows and hung up the phone. And when I hung up the telephone, I called into work and found out I had a job. And I called home and found out they were concerned. Concerned was always better than mad. And I found out that I still had a fiancé. And I thought, why in hell did you call Alcoholics Anonymous? Kind of a overreaction, Bob. I mean, you always feel guilty when you get up, and you know, I mean, it's, you're 23 years old, you're not an alcoholic. And it's kind of funny, it was kind of the first example of a higher power working in my life. I had made a promise to a stranger to go meet two other strangers, and for some reason I felt an obligation to go. And I had made promises to people I care about deeply and broke them with disgusting regularity, and here I made a, there was something about that conversation that I thought I better go, and I did. And I went over to that cafe and I met two guys, and I thought I could handle myself. If you wanted to sit me down and talk to me about my drinking, you had to be willing to do one of two things. You either had to be willing to discuss the most disgusting thing that I knew about you, or you had to be willing to wade through as much anger as I could put out. And the idea was, you can come and get me, baby, but it's not going to be for free. As a result, not too many people had heart-to-heart chats with me about my alcoholism. But these two fellas kind of threw a curve at me because they didn't talk to me about me. They talked to me about themselves. They were experienced enough that they knew how to make a 12-step call. They sat me down in that booth. They told me what their life had been like, what the drinking had been like, what happened to them, and what it was like, what they were like today. We have many treasures in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the ones that I think is so phenomenal is the fact that we speak from our experience rather than from our ideas. People don't care what you think. I mean, you can stand up with these microphones, and when someone starts getting real intellectual, they start sharing what they think, you can hear people start to cough and hack and get up and move and get coffee. You don't have to be very eloquent, but as long as you're talking from your own experience, people will sit and listen to you all day long in Alcoholics Anonymous. And these two men changed my life by sitting down and telling me about their life. I could have gotten up out of that booth and said, I don't want to do what you two guys did, but there was no way I could have gotten up out of that booth and not have known that what they said was so. It was just the way it was. I mean, they weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. There was no business. There was no, it was just, they told me that they were there as much for themselves as they were for me, and that sounded kind of funny when I sat down in the booth with them, but it became very clear as the conversation evolved that they had their own business and knew why they were there. And when they were done, it was effective enough, and I started to identify with them. And when they asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I said yes, and I was allowed the privilege to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that evening. Shortly thereafter, the next couple of months, I was to discover two things which had changed my life. And before I share those two things with you, I want to share who I was when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to get asked all the questions that young people get asked by those people who love them and care about them and think they're blowing their lives apart kind of on purpose. Last night I was at, kind of an aside, I was in Vancouver, and I was at a dinner with about 20 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had this older woman sitting next to me. And I thought she was an AA or Al-Anon, and I really didn't know the relationship. I just knew she was a friend of another woman that was at the table. And all this looks, she said, I don't think alcoholism is a disease. I was kind of thought that's an interesting lead-in. I thought, what the hell do you think it is? just checking. She said, I think it's voluntary. And I said, okay. She said, yeah, I had a woman. She started to tell me about this woman in the hospital. This lady had had something bad happen to her, and she actually had part of her, she had a serious medical condition. She was in the hospital, and the woman in the hospital in the next bed was dying of cirrhosis. And it was interesting to me that she could talk about that lady dying and think it was voluntary. You know, she said, I had two boys. I told my boys, you don't have to quit anything you don't start. And my sons have never had a problem. And I thought, well, I'm glad life's that simple. I hope it continues to be that simple. Life isn't that simple. For a lot of, and I really think that a lot of us get kind of confused. It looks voluntary. People ask you, why do you drink the way you drink? I never had a very good answer for that. What went on in my head was something, I said, I drink because I got problems. I don't have problems because I drink. If you know how many times I started out to have it all be okay, I'd get it okay just for a while and the wheels would fall out. I could just pick my batting average up about 5 points and get rid of some of my problems. I wouldn't have a drinking problem. So why don't we just talk about something else? I was lied between a sister who did graduate work at the Sorbonne and a brother who was Phi Beta Kappa in law school. And when you're lied between two show-offs like that, you don't look so good. So people ask you questions like, wouldn't you like to be like someone else? And I say, yeah, I'd like to be like someone else. Where are the directions? I mean, how do you do that? They always talk to you like you had all this stuff in reserve. You know, they always talk to you about potential. Like any moment you were going to turn it, you had all this stuff, you were going to kind of turn it on, and become a Rhodes Scholar or an Olympic athlete. It was all this. They never realized that everything I had was out there on the road. I mean, they don't appreciate what it takes to be an alcoholic. If normal people, they have no idea. They have no idea. We've got about 80% of our computer just managing misinformation. I mean, if a normal person had to manage the misinformation that we managed, they couldn't get dressed in the morning. I mean, they'd show up at work. They literally wouldn't be able to handle it. I said, yeah, I'd like to be an attorney. How do you do that? I mean, I'm doing the very best I know how to do. They come to me and they say, Bob's a hell of a guy if he just wouldn't drink. Very clear implication that what was wrong with me was swallowing bourbon. If I ever stopped swallowing bourbon, my life would clear up. Well, just like a lot of us, I had a couple of opportunities to quit drinking, and I went down, just before I went down to my senior year at school, I got into a lot of trouble, and I was beaten up, I was robbed, I was rolled, I was pistol whipped, I was shot at and thrown out of the second story of a hotel and ended up in bad shape. I got taken to a hospital, got treated, and they weren't going to let me go back to school. They're going to put me in a psych ward and find out why I kept doing these destructive sorts of things. And I was able to talk my way out and go back to my senior year. It was one of the best talks I've ever given under stress. And I went back on the condition that I wouldn't drink, and I didn't drink for 3 months. My life didn't instantaneously get better. I didn't all of a sudden become what I thought you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become an A student. I didn't become a model kid. And I thought, hey, I proved two things to myself. Number one is I could quit drinking anytime I wanted to because I was a daily drinker and I just quit for 3 months. And number two is don't tell me what's wrong with me is drinking bourbon because I just quit and my life didn't clear up. There's something else wrong with me. Bourbon's my answer. And once in a while it causes me a problem, but by and large it's consistent. It works for me about as well as anything I've ever found in my life. I know where to get it, how much of it to take. Life doesn't work for me sober. There's something different about me. I don't know what the hell it is. It's my answer. It's not my problem. They come to me and they say, Bob, I think you're an alcoholic. And I can say, I can see what the information you have about me, why you think I'm an alcoholic. But there's a lot of information you don't have about me. There's a lot of problems I had before I ever picked up a drink. Some of the worst behavior I've ever had in my life is sober. Some of the worst thinking I've ever had in my life is sober. I mean, alcohol may be a problem, but sober's a problem. There's something else wrong with me, and it's deep, and it's dark, and it's dirty, and it's different, and you don't know. Why don't we just get off my back and talk about something? Now, that was, to the very best of my recollection, the way I kind of thought about myself when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. 23 years old, scared stiff. I thought you were going to give me a test. You know, I was so used to being tested. They took me every place. When you're young and in trouble, you know, you're always, you know, brought someplace with people saying what's wrong with you. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that didn't happen to me. But I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found the most wonderful group of people I'd ever met in my life. I found a group of people who knew more about me without knowing me. It was like magic. I mean, it was like eerie. I thought people had literally, there were two people at the meeting who knew my mom and dad. I thought they had called my family. I mean, it was so, I'm just, you know, I mean, when you're young, I mean, you're just, and you're in trouble, and, you know, just how could they, why would they be having this conversation? The conversation just seemed too right on, you know, for what it was, you know, a little egocentric, nothing serious about that, you know, they planned the meeting for you, you know, now I realize that that's just a tad off, but at the time it made sense. And it was marvelous for me. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is no one ever asks you why. You can walk in and tell them you parked the car in the living room, no one ever asks you why. I mean, they just laugh. I mean, a normal person would ask you why. You could say, I don't think anybody would ever ask you why in Alcoholics Anonymous. The two discoveries I was allowed to make which have changed my life is this. Number one, that alcoholism is a disease. And you say, well, everybody knows that. Well, I did not know that. I thought alcoholism was something that happened to you when you were a lot older and a whole lot slapper, and you had a problem living your life because you're just physically drunk all the time. But I was told that alcoholism was a disease. It was physical, but also mental and spiritual, that once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affected you all the time, when you were drinking and when you were not drinking. And that was very important to me, because as much as I knew that drinking was spoiling my life, I knew that just stopping drinking wasn't going to clear my life if there was something else going on. Remember a person told me, he said, yeah. He said, you don't have a drinking problem. And I said, could you put that in writing? He said, no, smart aleck. He said, you had a drinking problem, but if all you have was a drinking problem, all you'd have to do is quit. He said, if you ever quit. And I said, yeah, I've quit. He said, did it work? I said, no, it didn't work. He said, I didn't think so, because what's wrong with us is alcoholism. The symptom of alcoholism is a drinking problem. But alcoholism is physical, mental, and spiritual. What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous once we take our last drink of alcohol is we use the 12 recovery steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find a different way to live. A different way to live that's sufficiently better than the way you lived before so that you don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for you that you were unwilling or unable to do for yourself. And if you don't find another way to live, you're going to go back to drinking and using because you don't know how to live straight. I think that's one of the truest things anybody's ever said to me. The other discovery I made is that there was an awful lot of people in those rooms who had drunk an awful lot of booze and taken an awful lot of drugs, and now they weren't doing it. The only observable reason for them not doing it is they like what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. It had occurred to me by now that I might have to quit drinking, but I thought my life was over. I mean, I thought it was going to be dull and flat and unfriendly and just, you know, just god-awful. But I sat in those meetings and I listened to you, and I identified with you. You were out there chasing the same thing I was chasing, and at some point in time it got more than you wanted and more than you could handle, and you quit. And your lives weren't over. There was a vitality about you. There was an energy about you. There was a laughter about you. And I Thank God that that was so. I drank twice after walking in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous, once on a business trip to the West Coast after 30 or 40 days of sobriety, and I was told to call AA the moment I got off the plane. I didn't. I told everybody I had a $200 bet. That kept me sober seven of the 14 days I was out there and got in trouble, and won't share that, bore you with that. And then I got sober for about 3.5 months, and we got married and went on our honeymoon. And I think everybody in the group knew I was going to drink on our honeymoon except me. I kind of denied that. We honeymooned in Acapulco, and you know where those divers dive off those cliffs in Acapulco? I dove off those cliffs on my last truck. And I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest, and I thought, God, that's not so tough. I went over and... Well, if you're picturing something classy, now this is, there's nothing classy about this. This is ugly American time. I go over and introduce myself to the ex-president of Mexico. I start there. Tell him his nephew was my roommate sophomore year. And then I go down and I dive off to one side, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. My wife's trying to bribe people to get this stupid man off the mountain. I got up to about 85 or 90 feet. I got stuck and I couldn't get up. I couldn't get down. And God watch it, after fools and drunks, as I dove. The last drink I had was on the airplane on the way home. I said to my wife once, I said, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever done. And she said, honey, it's not even on the top 10. she and I see things differently. So I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got active with a man with the name of Warren McGinley, who has spoken here at this meeting some many years ago, and who was the guy Lenny walked into at the detox center 18 or 19 years ago, and how many years ago, Lenny? 19 years ago in St. Paul. I used to work out there as a volunteer at the detox center, and it's marvelous to watch lives change. You watch the people coming up and getting their 30-day pen and their 60-day pen, and your lives are going to change. You just can't imagine how your lives are going to change. I mean, this is just literally a transformation, the opportunity that I think we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very unpredictable. But I think we see something in that new person, they walk in the door, that often the new person doesn't see in themselves. And I think that's what was so special when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought my failure. I brought a person I didn't like very well. I had no normal area of my life. But I think you saw something in me. But you knew more about the disease, and you know more about the answer to the disease, and you're able to love me and support me as I got active in my own recovery. One of the most early important things in my recovery was a breakdown of my alibi system. I had built a wall up around me to hide the things in my life I didn't want other people to see. The first thing drinking robbed me of was a little bit extra that I took to be a success at anything that I did. And then pretty soon, it took the hop off my fastball. And then I wasn't doing enough to get by. And when I wasn't doing enough to get by, I started to lie and cover up. I started to build a shield, a wall between you and me so you couldn't see the unattractive things that were going on in my life. The thinking that went on behind that wall went something like this. It said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, all the dark, dirty, lousy, unattractive, insufficient things about me, you wouldn't like me because I don't like me. Who knows more what a lousy person I am than me? But at some point in time behind that wall, I got sick enough and scared enough and afraid enough that I started to tear that wall down. I started when I called Alcoholics Anonymous, continued when I went in meetings, and it finished when I took my fist up. But I tore that wall down and I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand it 5 more minutes. And for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. Up until that time, no one had the whole block of information about me. People had pieces of it. My wife had part of it. My family had part of it. My employer had part of it. My friends had part of it. The police had part of it. My doctors had part of it. But no one had all of it. And I'd kill you with the piece you didn't have. You'd come to me and you'd say, Bob, I think you should do this. And I, in my mind, I'd say, you think I should do this because of what you know and you don't know, boom, boom, boom. I wouldn't tell you, boom, boom, boom. But I'd say, you don't know that, and if you knew that, you wouldn't think that. So I could neutralize anybody with the information they didn't have about me. Clancy talks about, if there's one thing, if there's a flag that all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous could pledge their allegiance to, the flag would say, but I'm different. If you're truly different, if you're truly unique, you're going to die in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if you're really different and you're really unique, what worked in my life won't work in yours. And an awful lot of people come in here with the same problem and the same disease and the same issue that we have. And they come in here with such a profound sense of uniqueness that they are unable to set that aside and find out the similarity. And if you are unable to set your uniqueness aside enough that it gets in the way of your recovery, you're not going to get well. And I was allowed the opportunity to tear my wall down and share my deck of cards, and I made a discovery, and the discovery was, is I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings, not my experience. And when I tore that wall down and shared those things, I made it, you know, I started for the first time to have a profound sense of hope that maybe what worked in your life could work in mine. And I've come to find out that that's exactly what happened to me, exactly the opportunity I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, that what worked in your life and changed your life worked in mine. You know, it's kind of a funny thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in and my life was just chaos. The only normal place I had in my whole life was in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the only pleasant, it was the only place people clapped. It was the only place people patted me on the head. I was the youngest person in the group for almost 2 years, and I had all these loving, supportive people who were around me. Told me I was doing great. For about 9 months, I was on a honeymoon, and it was wonderful. But you know, my idea is I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, hey, I'll buy it. I'm an alcoholic. I got the problem. You got the answer. Now, if I've got the problem and you've got the answer, I've got five or six other things that are going on in my life that are kind of serious. And if I've got the problem and you've got the answer, you'll be able to make those things go away. And I'll be reasonable. Hell, it might take a year. It takes more than a year. Problems I had when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, in addition to my alcoholism, were horrible but ordinary. I had unmanageability in most of the major areas of my life. I couldn't get up in the morning, set the alarm clock for 6:30 and get up at 8:15. It's tough to be at work at 8 when you get up at 8:15. For an alcoholic, it's not impossible, but it's difficult. I mean, it's really... I spent about $300 more a month than I made. And if you do that over a real long period of time, you end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're out there running that one. I had a gambling problem. It was really more like a hobby. It was, you know, kind of like a second job. 3 to 4 hours a day, 4 to 5 days a week. But I was making $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon. I thought it was kind of a work ethic, kind of like a second job. It was really kind of a deal. I had a wife who was starting to get kind of unhappy with me, wondering if one of the places I was supposed to practice the principles of the program was in our home. I thought, God, that's just none of your business. I mean, you should be happy that I'm sober and all this stuff. I mean, you should be grateful. A lot of people still have husbands that are drinking up. By this time, we're having children. We have, we now have three, but we're having two kids. You know, I had a great mom and dad, and I was even, but even great parents make a few mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the few mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made a few mistakes they made and a whole bunch they never thought of. I was an immature, loud, angry, sometimes violent, mouthy parent. Not a good combination. Impatient, I should add to that. Now, these problems that I had were not annual problems. They were not quarterly problems. They were not monthly or weekly. They were daily. I had every one of these problems when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous and never noticed them. I didn't notice them very much during my entire first year of sobriety. I spent most of my time going to Alcoholics Anonymous, meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing some 12-step work, and just trying to calm my life down. I vibrated when I came in. I had a guy leave a meeting because of how I was just kind of bouncy. He said, look at that guy. That guy's a nervous wreck. He said, if that's what it does, I said, I don't want any part. He got up and left the meeting. Kind of embarrassing. I went down the steps after the guy, stopped the guy, and I said, look, you ass. I said, you never saw me when I came in. I'm better. Now, come on. Grabbed him, pulled him back up, and brought him in the meeting. And but I had these issues and problems, and I didn't notice them because I was so excited about Alcoholics Anonymous, what I was learning in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I was learning about my recovery. Towards the end of my first year and during my second year, one by one, I started to get me handed to me. And these issues started to arise, and I got in touch with them. At first, when they came up, I kind of push them down, but it's kind of like one of those water beds or something. You push it over here, and it comes up over here. You push it down over here, and it comes up over here. And by the end of my second year, I was in touch with more than I had been significantly with the unmanageability of my life. My biggest fear, I had two fears when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. One was that it would work. The other was that it wouldn't work. If I was to tell you a story that's the story of my life, it'd be a story about a guy who, if we were going to all get together and have a race, we're going to go for a mile race. Okay, I'm going to be a guy who's going to have a great set of tennis shoes. I'm going to buy a nice little pair of shorts. I'm going to have a t-shirt on. I'm going to look like a runner. I'm going to talk like a runner. When we're all kind of hanging around, stretching, you know, I'm going to be up towards the front, and you're going to get the impression that I'm a pretty good runner. This guy from Minnesota, maybe like I won a race in Minnesota, and that if I do okay, if I do normal, like maybe I should be one of the top five or six or seven or eight people in this race. Now, when the race takes off, for the first third of the race, I will be with the top 5 to 15 people in that race. And somewhere between the third and the halfway mark, I will fall down and drop out of the race. And when the race is over, someone's going to say, what the hell happened to that guy from Minnesota? He's a hell of a guy. God, I think he won some race back there, and he was up in front, and then all of a sudden something must have pulled a hamstring or something. If you had followed me around in my life in a helicopter for the 5 years preceding that race, you could have predicted within 15 yards when I would have fallen down. I never finished anything. I'm a great starter. I'm well equipped. I got great form. I just don't have any substance. I never finished anything. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my greatest fear is, you know, I'm kind of like you. There's a lot of similarities. I mean, you know, in the meetings, we talk about all this stuff, but I'm different. I'm just a little, there's something, I don't know whether it's a built-in failure mechanism or just a half turn off, but I'm different. I mean, it seems to work for you. But I'm 2 years sober, I'm 3 years sober, I'm 4 years sober, I'm 5 years sober. I mean, I go to work, I don't know what to do at work. You put me behind a desk, I look for the steering wheel. I'm 24 years, I don't know what the hell to do behind a desk. I go to work, I can't stay at work. I go on out, I'm at a 2.5 hour AA lunch because anytime, anywhere the hand of AA reaches out, I'm supposed to be there. I'm at 7 meetings a week and my wife thinks I should be home 3 nights a week and we're having fights about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd be at the club and a new person would come in and you get that new person a cup of coffee and they share all their problems with you and you say, hey, I'm glad you're here. You're in the right place. I know you don't know it. If you just stay in here and go to meetings and do the things that we ask you to do, it's going to be okay. I know you don't know how it's going to be okay, but it's going to be okay. You see that guy over there? God, his life was a mess. That girl over there, her life is terrible. Now it's great. Keep coming back. You're in the right place. Then I get in the car and I drive home and I say, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? You're 6 years sober, Bob. You just went to a clothing store and bought a $400 sport coat. You had a $700 bill at that clothing store. When's it going to be okay for you? When are you going to learn how to work? I think you're supposed to know how to work, Bob. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe you've got an exemption, but I mean, most people know how to work. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to be a husband? When are you going to be a father? When are you going to stop spending money you don't have? When are you going to stop gambling? Now, the problem with this is I'm working my prat off to try to change these things, and daily I'm failing. Now, I know what the answer is. By this time, I'm sober 6 or 7 years. And by the way, I don't think the timing of these things is so important. So when I say 6 or 7 years, I don't think you have to be a goof for 6 or 7 years like I was. I promise, I know you aren't going to get it all done in a year. You know, but I don't think this is a 7-year syndrome that I'm talking about. I mean, but I do think you're going to get it handed to you somewhere between 5 and 10 years of sobriety. I think you're going to get, you're going to come in, and for the first 2 or 3 years, you're just going to get your system calmed down, and you're going to get in touch with it. You're going to know where the meetings are and the rooms and how to get there and how to park your car and, you know, get the terminology down, you know, and all this sort of thing. And somewhere around the 5th year, you're going to start to smell peanuts. And around somewhere between 5 and 10 years, you're going to wake up and there's going to be an elephant in your living room. And it's been there all the time. Now, because I've been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been able, you know, the first 3 or 4 times I don't hear things, and I start to hear it maybe the 5th and 6th time. Because I was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to hear it the 5th and 6th time. And I started to get a sense of what was going to change my life. And what I thought was going to change my life was a relationship with the God of my very own understanding. Now, the problem with that is you go knock on the door, and God says, who's there? And you say, God is Bob. God says, what do you want? And I said, well, I want my life to clear up. I'm working my ass off in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life's a mess. I'm going to 5 or 6 meetings a week. I'm active in service. Everybody thinks I'm doing good. I don't know what the heck's going on. Don't they see that my life's a mess? I mean, they're still telling me I'm doing fine. My wife doesn't think I'm doing fine. My kids don't think I'm doing fine. They're not giving me prizes at work. No one's clapping. I'm not doing fine. My life's a mess. I'd like my life to get straightened out. God says, okay, I'll help. I'm saying, well, what am I supposed to do? And God's going to say, well, quit gambling. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Don't spend more money than you make. Be nice to your wife and children. I'm going to say, hell, if I could do that, I wouldn't need God. I can't play. Now, I was a guy who could put the football uniform on. I could go in the locker room. I could do the calisthenics. I could run around the field. I could hit the dummies. I rolled in the grass, got stains on my uniform. When they blew the whistle and started the game and got into blocking and tackling, I went up to the stands. Because I don't like blocking and tackling. Let me tell you something about life. There are no stands. It's all playing field. It's a funny thing. I wondered why I had these bruises on my body. You know, because I was in bruises on my body because I'm in the middle of a goddamn game and I think I'm in the stands. I'm in the middle of the field. You know, thinking I'm hiding in the stands. I mean, it's kind of dumb, you know. Have you ever seen a referee get, you know, blind, you know, sighted? Once I got in touch, I remember that psychologist looking over me and said, why are you so afraid of failing? I wanted to kill him. I mean, I just literally wanted to tear his nose off. I said, look, you goof. You know? I said, you lose everything you have. You go bankrupt. They put your name in the paper. See, I remember he looked over at my wife and he said, Linda, if Bob lost everything he had, would you still be there? She said, yeah, I'd be there. He said, would your kids be there? I said, yeah, they'd be there. And all of a sudden, I started to engage in a conversation that maybe I could survive failing. And I was able to take some things that I wasn't doing very well and get them back in my program and get on with my life. I used, and after I took that 5th step with my sponsor and went to the psychologist, I was home one night. And I just had a horrible couple of days. I was at home reading some non-conference approved literature. And it had been a horrible day. One of those days where I hadn't done anything I was supposed to do, and I'd done a whole bunch of things where I wasn't supposed to do, and I said, gee, it happened again. I said, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? You know? I said, yeah, I was there, but it's so habitual. You know, what I did is I got out of work at about 11 o'clock, and I was just going to go downtown and do a business thing, and I got down and I got in a backgammon game. And I got in a backgammon game and I missed dinner. I missed the AA meeting. I lost $300. Won $300. I can't remember anymore. I came home, got in a fight with my wife, slapped one of the kids, and I'm in my living room. One of those great, you'd like someone to videotape it and send it to General Service. You know, what's it like at 8 years? You know? And I sat down and I realized that what I said was nonsense, that my life was exactly the way it was because I chose it and designed it and built it exactly the way it was. I talk like I wanted to get rid of gambling. If you think I really wanted to get rid of gambling, talk to my wife. talk to my partner. I wanted to gamble when I wanted to gamble for whatever I wanted to gamble with and not have problems. It sounded like I wanted my financial life to straighten out. I didn't want my I wanted to be able to spend as much money whenever I wanted to spend it and not have financial problems. It sounded like I wanted to get my work. I didn't want to get my work straightened out. I wanted to not work and have money. Sounded like I wanted to be a good father. I didn't want to be a good father. I wanted to not spend time with my kids and be a good father. I had their love and approval. I had my wife's love and approval. It was the rest of the world's love and approval that I wanted. And for some, you know, the truth changes you. I think one of the things about the truth is that for some reason we were given the grace to stand in front of our alcoholism, stark naked with all our clothes off, and look into that mirror at some point in time we walked into AA. And when you really look that in the eye, your life is never again the same. You may drink again, but it ain't gonna be the same once you know the truth. And that night, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I gave you my drinking and the things that related directly to my drinking, and I never took another drink since the 10th of December, 1967. I didn't give you my sex life. I didn't give you my marriage. I didn't give you my I didn't know I was supposed to give that to you. I guess I could have figured that out. I could have listened to it, but I thought, you get me well, I'll handle it. You get me well from alcoholism and I'll manage the rest. I don't have the power to manage the rest. What I manage got unmanageable. And that night I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clear my life up, and my life was still a mess, and I realized that I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the seventh step said that we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I submit that you go about the process of getting rid of your defects of character differently than you go about the process of getting entirely ready to have God remove them. You know how we change in Alcoholics Anonymous? A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He creates a fertile soil, plants a seed, creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. I do not have the power to grab my life by the throat and just change everything in my life. But once I put myself in cooperation with the power that I think is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, unbelievable things can happen. Because have the people stand up and share their stories. I mean, you have the privilege of hearing lots of people talk in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've heard Clancy talk and John Harris and Duffy and all these guys. How the hell can you go from where they were and where their lives were, you know, from prisons, from mental institutions, and we listen to them and tears run down our face and we think that's a wonderful story, and then we sit around and we say, gee, I wonder if it works on marriage. I wonder if it works when you're checking accounts, $1,000 overdrawn. I wonder if it can work on a work problem. It works on life. My alcoholism didn't go away when I took my last drink. The problem that my alcohol solved when I picked up my first drink was there alive and well when I put down my last. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous today, not for a drinking problem I had 23 years ago. It was for a living problem that I have today. I'm treating the mental and spiritual aspects of my disease. I think the bad news is you've got a disease. If you don't deal with the disease, it's going to kill you. It's going to eat your life up. It's going to eat the life up of 5 to 10 people around you, and it's just going to get crappier and crappier and crappier. That's the bad news. The good news is that in order to get well from the disease, you have to learn how to live. Not a bad trade. Most of us will be weller as a result of having the disease of alcoholism than we would have been had we never had the problem, I think. As a result of being exposed and putting these principles in action in our lives, we will be able to reach potentials and do things that we would never have done and never had to have done had we never had this program put in our lives. Today, what's my life like? I'm in love with my wife today. No way I would have been married in love with my wife if it wasn't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a 21, a 19, and a 10-year-old boy, all boys. Today, I'm a pretty good father. Still the most demanding area of my life. I think being a parent takes about 125% of whatever you got. I mean, it's just got you in the game all the way. But I think, you know, I have a good relationship with my children and my wife, and they're individuals today. They are extensions of my ego. Work. You know, I, with my partner, run a company with 400 employees. I don't have a problem working today. My work is a catastrophe at the moment. I'm in commercial real estate. Commercial real estate, after the change in the tax, I'm just swimming in problems. I've never been more intimidated by the issues that I have at work. I have financial problems. I'm mysterious. When, at 7 years sober, what I did to straighten my life out, I gave the finances to my wife. My wife knew how to pay a third of a bill. Okay. Okay, I didn't say that. I hired someone to get me up in the morning. Okay? Someone for whom I'd get up for. You know, I never missed a trip. I never missed handball. I just missed work. You know, I just... So I got someone who I'd get up for. I quit gambling. I made appointments to go to work. I made appointments to stay to work. I started to date my wife. I've dated my wife every Friday night. And when I'm not home on Friday night, I date her one other night. It's a real, live, dangerous date. One day a week, no matter what. No one else goes on it. It's us. Now, I didn't want to go out alone with her. I didn't want to be with her alone. Now, it's a... It's the best thing we have ever done for our relationship. Today, still so. Those stabilities that I put in my life, I was able to maintain with the support of my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I know how to work. But today, I'm back having financial issues. I mean, my business, from the time I took that on, from the time I took that fifth step and made those changes in my life and had the sixth and the seventh step, my life just took off. I mean, I had 10 years of the most, of the damnedest success I've ever experienced. I mean, it was just awesome. And now I'm going backwards, and it ain't much fun. God's cut my allowance in half. I mean, it is. Actually, he's cut it in a third, to be more accurate. And I am now having, we have the B word in our family, the budget word's back in, and we're having that conversation a lot. My wife is back managing our money. I put myself on an allowance. I don't want to have to worry about that, and I don't like that. I don't like having to explain things. I'm not an explainer. I'm a teller. I'm having to explain things. I don't like that. But that's reality. I am back. Telling Lenny, you know, I'm intimidated by my business. I don't know exactly how my business is going to turn out. I mean, I've got serious issues. I'm, you know, in commercial real estate. Leverage is a wonderful thing, but it's like being in bed with an elephant that starts to roll over and you have to have to move and adapt. And I'm doing that. But, you know, I guess a lot of times when people are troubled at periods of times in their life, they either get more active in Alcoholics Anonymous or less active, and I had the good grace or sense to get a little bit more active. And for a while, I was sponsoring mostly people who had 5 to 10 years of sobriety, and all of a sudden, in the last year and a half, I picked up about 4 or 5 people who are sober in their first year, and it has been the most wonderful, invigorating thing in my life. And it's another interesting thing. My 21-year-old is in the program, has got 3.5 years of sobriety. My 19-year-old just came home from Christmas and totaled the car, ended up being arrested for drunken driving, ended up in detox. And he just went through treatment. He's in a halfway house. And he's at the same halfway house that I happen to be sponsoring 3 or 4 graduates of. And all of a sudden, I'm familiar with the place. There's people there that... that are helping my kid. And there are people that are starting their lives over. And I've been afraid I might have to do that myself. It's hard to feel sorry for yourself in AA. I mean, just about the time you think you've got it tough, I mean, there's another person next to you who's got about 50% more to carry than you got, and they're doing it with a grace and dignity that, you know, you're sitting there kicking and screaming, crying and yelling, and someone there is just picking it up and carrying it. Thank God, that's interesting. I guess you could do that. I've never known more about who I am than when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes in business, I don't know who I am. Sometimes in different circumstances, I wonder exactly what I'm supposed to do. But when I'm in a meeting of AA, I know who I am and what I am. I've just been privileged to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You've changed my life. You've given me my life. I heard a story the other day. You know, you never want, you know, I can't tell you how much I want my children to have what I had in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I want them to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want AA to be there. I don't want BA or BZ or, I want Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not one of these guys that think we should give urine tests at the door and ask a bunch of questions. But I want the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous available to my family if they have the problem. I want it kept alive with the same vitality. One of the reasons it's just thrilling for me to watch the vitality and energy in this room is it is being kept alive. But it isn't like there aren't issues and problems, and it isn't as if it might never go away. And I used to tell one story, but I'm going to try a different story when I end my talk. There was a story about a guy who learned how to make fire when no one else in the world knew how to make fire. And he went to northern tribes, and he brought fire to a northern tribe. It was cold, and they didn't have fire, and he taught them how to cook their food with the fire and how to heat themselves with the fire. And it was a wonderful gift, and they were all amazed, and they went turned around to thank this guy, and he was gone. He didn't want thanks. He just wanted to show them how to improve their lives and show them how to make fire. And then he went to another tribe, and he sat down, and he showed them how to make fire, and the people were very impressed with it, and started to use it. But the leaders and the leaders of the tribes didn't like this so good. They started to replace them. So they got this guy, and they killed him, stoned him, shot him, crucified him, killed him. But they were worried about what the people were going to do, so they put a picture of the guy up on a wall and put the tools for making fire under his picture. And they worship the tools and they worship the guy, but they don't know how to make fire. There are rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the country that have pictures of Bob and Bill and have the steps on the wall. In some of those places, they've forgotten how to make fire. I hope that when my kids or your grandkids walk into a room like this 20 years from now, they walk into a room of people who know how to make fire. Thank you very much.